Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now.
I'm glad you could join me to discuss my favorite topic, which is movies. And I am going with another week of not revealing what's topping the box office, specifically because I think every single movie theater in America, and probably even the world, is closed. And for that matter, it's probably all for the best. But the good news is, because we live in the 21st century, there are plenty of options to watch on demand. And the vast majority of the movies that I will be reviewing for this show, I've actually seen on streaming. In my case, it's Netflix. And I probably actually will even consider getting a subscription to other streaming services like Hulu or Disney Plus. I've been considering it for a long time, but now that I'm pretty much sequestered in my home, going out only to do this radio show and do groceries, I might even consider investing in those options. And I'm a little bit more financially stable than I was even a year ago, but in any event, I'll just get into my reviews right now. And the first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is one that is brand new to Netflix, and it is an original film. It's rated TVMA, and I'm not exactly sure why Netflix has some movies that are rated the usual way that movies are rated, PG-13, R, and the rest. I don't think that Netflix would ever release an NC-17 movie, but even if they would, they haven't yet, as far as I know. But there are other films of theirs that are rated TVG, TVMA, and basically the entire TV rating system. I don't know what the differentiation is, but the first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is, first of all, a movie that premiered yesterday on Netflix and is still available for streaming, and secondly, it's rated TVMA. If it were a theatrically released movie, it would be rated R. This movie is Coffee and Kareem. It's a movie that stars Ed Helms and Taraji P. Henson. Ed Helms is a Detroit police officer, and Taraji P. Henson is his love interest, who has been married previously and has a precocious 12-year-old son who does not take kindly to the new man in his life. And 12-year-old Kareem Manning, that's the name of the character in this movie, who's played by Terrence Little Gardenhigh, who I have not seen in anything else recently, but he hires a criminal to scare his mom's new boyfriend, as I said, the police officer played by Ed Helms, whose character's name is James Coffey, but it backfires, forcing Coffey and Kareem, the name of the duo here, to team up in order to save themselves from Detroit's most ruthless drug kingpin. The movie is directed by Michael Dowse, based with a story and a screenplay written by, written by Shane Mack. And Michael Dowse has, let's see what else he's directed. He actually directed Stuber from last year, which was a pretty good movie. I think it was one of those films that was a bit formulaic, but if it had Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart in it, it probably would have been even more formulaic and probably would have been considered a direct ripoff of the movie they did, Central Intelligence, from 2016. But Stuber with Kumail Nanjiani and Dave Bautista was actually, I thought, a pretty funny film. And when I reviewed it last year, I gave it a knockout. I can't exactly say the same for the movie Coffee and Kareem. It's one of those movies that's an atypical buddy cop film with an odd couple. And the movie might have worked, especially with that pressure of there being a potential stepdad in this 12-year-old boy's life. But it really didn't work because this movie was just overly desperate to be funny and also overly desperate to be edgy as well. And I thought also the dialogue written for the 12-year-old in this movie was just, either it wasn't very well written or it wasn't very well delivered. Either way, it was one of those instances where the screenwriter tried to make this 12-year-old kind of too smart for his own good. And that was just one of the things that didn't really work in this movie. Another thing was, as much as I like Ed Helms, and I've liked him in most things I've seen him in, from The Office, the TV show, to at least the first Hangover movie. And I wasn't even the biggest fan of any of the Hangover movies, but most especially the original. I still think it's kind of overrated, but I still like Ed Helms. I still think he's funny, but he's going to add Coffee and Kareem to his his repertoire of films, like the reboot of Vacation, where I could see Ed Helms is trying his best, but it's just not enough to save this film. Plus, he and Taraji P. Henson have no chemistry whatsoever. And both of them are really good actors. Hell, Taraji P. Henson is an Oscar nominee. And I actually expected better from her as well. I didn't think she was especially bad in this film, but I just thought the two of them weren't really believable as a romantic couple. And it's really too bad, because I think that, I don't know if it's necessarily the acting, the actors trying too hard, or if it's just the way the screenplay is written. But the person who wrote the screenplay, again, named Shane Mack, this is actually his very first feature film for which he's written the screenplay. He's also written some shorts that I haven't seen. One of the shorts, and I'm not making this up, is called The Guy Who's Effing Your Girlfriend. And I could say what that word effing is, but I am on FM radio, so I'm not going to say that. But even when I had my show just on internet radio and on iTunes, I still wouldn't say that word. I'm keeping the show clean. Those are my two rules for the show. Number one, keep it clean. And number two, no spoilers. So I'm not exactly going to say exactly what happens in this film. In terms of there being some twists and turns here and there, there are, but I guess when you see a cop, particularly in a messed up city like Detroit, with all due respect to the people who live there, I don't know if they listen to the show, but I haven't been to Detroit in years. I just hear really bad things. But my point is that when there's a cop as the central character and he's being framed for both murder and, in a direction I really wish this movie hadn't gone, child molestation. And there are some jokes here where they deal with, or they actually bring up the implication that Ed Helms might be sexually molesting his soon-to-be stepson. That really wasn't necessary, and none of those jokes were funny. I just think that the movie just loses its comedic credibility, which it certainly does in this case. And it's a good thing I saw this movie streaming. I'm not sure if this came to streaming through Netflix because of the coronavirus, but I would seriously doubt that, because overall it's not a very good movie. There is a lot of action, there is a lot of violence in this film, but none of the violence is believable, and none of the comedy is particularly funny. There was only one line that the actor who plays Kareem Manning, who again is named Terrence Little Gardenhigh, there's one thing he says about one of the other officers, whose name is Detective Watts, who's played by Betty Gilpin, another actress who is way too good for this movie, where he says that she looks like an older Taylor Swift on meth. That was the only line at which I laughed. The rest of it was just kind of drivel. And Coffee and Kareem had a lot of, as I said, comedic possibilities. It had some good actors in the film. Ed Helms, Taraji P. Henson, Betty Gilpin. I've seen them in much better films. This was just a very flaccid comedy that kind of stooped to a really big low when it came to making jokes about pedophilia. Pedophilia is not funny. I don't think you can throw any jokes into anything to make pedophilia funny. It was certainly no exception for the movie Coffee and Kareem, and it gets my rating of a flunk out. And I would actually think, not only would the actors in this film, who have been established enough to have to choose their own screenplays, to read them and to pick and choose from their material. I would think they would know better, but most importantly, I would think that Netflix would know better by this point. And to see a movie like Coffee and Kareem debut on Netflix, who have that has a streaming platform that has released much better films in their repertoire, like Marriage Story and The Irishman, I would imagine that Netflix would be well established at this point to stay away from this film. But then again, there used to be a saying about movies that are bad, even if they have big stars, before the streaming revolution where they went directly to video. So streaming is kind of a double-edged sword in the sense that you can watch a film and not waste money, unlike maybe going to the theaters where you waste time and money on a potentially bad film. But there is, of course, that stigma of direct-to-streaming that I don't even think movies that are released directly to Netflix, like Marriage Story or The Irishman, as I said previously, would give full credibility necessarily. But Coffee and Kareem, you may not be wasting your money if you see it on Netflix, if you have a Netflix subscription, but you would certainly be wasting your time, and that is especially a big disappointment. Listening to the show Words on Film, which is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures, and I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is another Netflix original, which is called Spencer Confidential. And I was actually a little bit more excited about this film than I was about Coffee and Kareem. Actually, I was pretty excited about Coffee and Kareem based on the fact that the actors I mentioned are usually great, except for this film. But Spencer Confidential, fortunately, I saw before I saw Coffee and Kareem, and it's better, but it's still not particularly good. It has Mark Wahlberg joining forces with director Peter Berg for the third time that I can remember. And Peter Berg is an actor, and if you see him, he certainly has a familiar face, if you don't mistake him for Ethan Hawke. But among his directorial efforts include Mile 22, which came out in 2018, and that was a Mark Wahlberg starring action flick, which was pretty decent, but overall forgettable. He also directed Mark Wahlberg in Patriot's Day, the movie about the Boston Marathon, which could have been a better film, especially considering that I lived through the Boston Marathon, and there was a lot of embellishments, particularly when it came to Mark Wahlberg's scenes in that movie. He also directed Mark Wahlberg in Deepwater Horizon, another film based on a true story, which I didn't exactly live through because I don't live near the Gulf of Mexico where Deepwater Horizon happened, but I did sort of feel like Peter Berg put in that bit of embellishment in there. And he also directed Mark Wahlberg in another movie based on a true story called Lone Survivor. And I won't delve in too much about that because I got to get into my review of Spencer Confidential. But let me just say that the title of the movie, Lone Survivor, gave away what happened in the end. Not, of course, the whole ending, but you basically know who lives. So Spencer Confidential, unlike the other movies which pairs Mark Wahlberg with Peter Berg, is actually not a true story. It's about a disgraced Boston police officer by the name of Spencer. We're not given a last name. And he, of course, is played by Mark Wahlberg. And he is actually sent to prison for assault and battery against a crooked cop. But when he's released from prison, and two Boston police officers, including the one whom he assaulted, are murdered, he teams up with his no-nonsense roommate, Hawk, who's played by a good actor by the name of Winston Duke, to take down the criminals who killed these cops. And I will just spoil one thing, and I won't spoil the entire movie, but usually when I spoil part of a film, First of all, it's not a complete spoil. And secondly, I spoil it to prove a point. Usually, I spoil part of a movie when it is really cliche. And you have Mark Wahlberg's character here, who is a former Boston police officer, and he has friends who are still in the force, including a detective by the name of Driscoll, who's played by Bokeem Woodbine, who's one of those actors who's very familiar, who has a very familiar face, if you don't mistake him for Dave Chappelle. Yeah, Bokeem Woodbine and Dave Chappelle, are like doppelgangers. They look almost exactly the same. And maybe when they start talking, you can tell the difference between the two of them. But that's not my issue with this movie. My issue with the movie is it looks like these two Boston cops were murdered by members of the criminal underworld of Boston. But eventually, and here's the spoiler, it's a minor spoiler, there are crooked cops that are behind the murder. And there is, yeah, basically, I think within maybe about 30 minutes of the film, when these two murders of cops happen, you kind of know there's going to be somebody who in the Boston police force or any police force in which the film takes place, there's going to be somebody crooked in there. It is such a movie cliche, and unfortunately, this movie falls for it. And based on the story, there's not too much that's too surprising here. Plus, as much as I like Mark Wahlberg, and as great as he is in movies like Boogie Nights or The Departed, it seems like when he teams up with Peter Berg, it's just kind of one action movie or one cop movie cliche after another. And it's really too bad, because this movie actually has an excellent supporting cast, including this guy Winston Duke, who is a big black guy who has been in a number of films. He's probably best known to mainstream audiences for playing Lupita Nyong'o's husband in Us. And he was excellent in that movie. I won't go off on too much of a tangent about how great the movie Us was, but it is definitely one of the best horror films of the last decade, 2010 to 2019. Yeah, that decade is over. We still don't have a name for that decade. I want to call it the Millennium Teens. And anybody who's watching the show on my webcast right now, if you want to take that, turn into a meme, run with it, be my guest. But please give me full credit for it. But he was also in Black Panther and a number of the Avengers movies. So Winston Duke is an excellent actor. And he and Mark Wahlberg actually did really well in the scene, in the scenes they're in, not just the action scenes, but also some of the downtime scenes where they're just either hanging out or going to a restaurant. So I'd like the two of them together, and I'd like to see Winston Duke get the household name and the credibility that he deserves. I also really liked Alan Arkin in this film as Spencer's, I guess, landlord, maybe his uncle. I don't know. That's not particularly well established, but either way, he's played by Alan Arkin. And Alan Arkin, who is a native New Yorker, does not do a particularly great Boston accent. I don't think he even tries, but Alan Arkin doesn't exactly have to try in this case. There's also another subplot that I didn't necessarily think was needed, and it involves Spencer and his, I guess, on-again, off-again girlfriend, Sissy Davis, who's played by Eliza Schlesinger. That last name, forgive me for those of you people who have that last name who might be listening to me, that is a hard name to pronounce. It's almost like you inevitably sound like you're drunk when you try to pronounce the last name Schlesinger. But either way, she is a relatively familiar actress who's been in movies like Instant Family, also with Mark Wahlberg, without Peter Berg, by the way. She was in that film. She was also on an ABC series called Forever 31. I haven't seen it, but in this film, she does have a good Boston accent, but again, there's that cliche of the nagging girlfriend that doesn't particularly work in this film. She is kind of an annoying character. I didn't think she was particularly needed. So, Spencer Confidential is a movie I wanted to like, not only because I like Mark Wahlberg, but also because it was filmed on location in Boston. It has some amazing panoramic shots of some Boston landmarks, but I think it also falls into that trap that a lot of Boston films have been falling into lately, where you have the people with the exaggerated Boston accent who are naming various locations and streets on all parts of Boston. It's something that's been done, I think, a little bit too much. And directors like Gus Van Sant, Clint Eastwood, Martin Scorsese didn't quite fall into that trap of having their characters name each and every landmark in Boston. And all three of those directors were not from Boston. Of course, they had a supporting cast of people who, of course, were from the Boston area, but they focused on the story more than this name your destination game that some lesser Boston films have fallen into lately. So Spencer Confidential has some good things about it, but it is a narrow miss for me and it gets my rating of a strikeout. Again, I do think that Mark Wahlberg is falling into that trap of playing the tough guy too often. And it's a trap that, unfortunately, some other good actors, like Liam Neeson most especially, has been falling into in his last couple of films. And Liam Neeson, my God, man, getting off on a little bit of a tangent here, he's becoming almost like a poor man's Charles Bronson. But for a guy who was in Schindler's List, one of the greatest movies of all time, one of my top 10 favorite movies, Liam Neeson should not be the poor man's anything. And Mark Wahlberg is not the poor man's anything either. I think he is a unique screen presence. I don't think he's falling into the trap that Liam Neeson does where he's playing just tough guys. And that's great. But I just hope that he doesn't continue to play these kind of two-dimensional roles that I know Mark Wahlberg is better than playing. Hell, even in movies that take place in Boston, in which Mark Wahlberg stars, especially The Departed, for which he was nominated for an Oscar, he didn't just play a tough guy. He played a guy who was tough, no doubt, but he also had this very cool sense of humor that I'm certainly familiar with growing up in New England. I didn't grow up in Boston, but I lived there for 11 years. I do miss the city. Of course, I will have mad love for Boston until the day I die. And even after I die, I'll still have mad love for Boston as I'm being elevated to heaven. But again, the Boston film is falling into a few too many cliches, and I really, really hope that there is another great Boston movie that comes out besides The Departed and Good Will Hunting and Mystic River and the list goes on. Just want to let you guys know that you are listening to the show Words on Film, which is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures, and I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is another Netflix original that actually premiered in the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And the Sundance Film Festival is a film festival amongst many that I would love to go to at least once in my life, and I may. But if I were there, I probably would have seen this film, which is Lost Girls, which premiered mid-January at Sundance and premiered on Netflix on March 13th, 2020, and is still available for streaming right now. I do know that Netflix takes movies in and out of streaming all the time. I don't know them to actually take their Netflix originals out of streaming, but considering how many series and movies that they release on a monthly basis, eventually there are going to be movies that are going to be, that are Netflix originals that are going to be taken out of streaming. But for now, Lost Girls is available to stream. And this movie stars Amy Ryan as a woman by the name of Mary Gilbert, who lives in a small town in upstate New York. And she has a daughter whose name is Shannon, who disappears. And when she does, police in action drives her own Mary Gilbert's own investigation into the gated Long Island community where Shannon was last seen. Her search brings attention to over a dozen murdered sex workers. And this is one of those films that, I'm not going to spoil the ending, but I will say that it ends on a grim note. And I do like that the movie does not end on a hopeful note. There are some movies where a hopeful note is not only welcome, but also appropriate. But there is a killer out there who's known as the Long Island Killer who may have killed Mary Gilbert's daughter. And Mary Gilbert is a real person. You could look her up. I'm trying to not spoil anything, but this is absolutely a true story. Of course, with other true stories that are brought to the screen, there are some moments that have been, and dialogue that have been embellished for dramatic purposes, but overall, the main sequence of the things that happen in this movie are true. And you can certainly see this movie has a little bit of a bias in the sense that the movie emphasizes the police in action, but I don't think it does it very evenly. The movie, by the way, is directed by a woman by the name of Liz Garbus. And Liz Garbus has directed, she's produced several films, but in terms of her directorial efforts, she has directed such documentaries as What Happened, Miss Simone. And I have not actually seen that documentary, but I know that that documentary was nominated for an Academy Award. I don't think it actually won, but this is actually Liz Garbus's first narrative film. It's a film that's based on a true story, and I'm actually surprised that it doesn't have more documentary footage in it, but it has a fair amount. And Liz Garbus has actually been nominated for two Academy Awards. One was for Best Documentary Feature for What Happened, Miss Simone from 2016. The other one was for a movie called The Farm, Angola, USA, which came out in 1998 and was nominated for one of the 1999 Oscars. So I think that actually Liz Garbus does a good job directing actors in this film. And you can definitely tell when there's a director who knows how to direct actors. There are certainly directors who don't. And even if they're lucky enough to have actors who have had other critically acclaimed roles or have even been nominated or won Oscars, that they turn in bad performances because the director doesn't quite know exactly what to do with them. That's not the case for Liz Garbus's relationship in this movie with Amy Ryan. Amy Ryan is undoubtedly the best thing about this film. Of course, I don't know what it's like to have a family member go missing and having to report it to the police and going through what I can imagine to be the excruciating process of feeling as if the police aren't doing enough. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of families who probably have to go through that every day. Not just the realization that their family members are missing and might be dead, but also the fact that it seems like not enough people in their world, in their circle, their community, are helping them. I can only imagine what that feels like. But what this movie doesn't do particularly well is emphasize the police in action in this case. Again, there is a detective in this film who's played by Dean Winters, probably best known to mainstream audiences as the guy from the Allstate commercials who represents mayhem. And other than the Allstate commercials, in which he's very funny in that deadpan kind of way, he is very good in the movies and TV shows in which I've seen him act. I think probably even more inconsistently is the police commissioner in this film, whose name is Richard Dormer, who's played by Gabriel Byrne. If you are going to depict a police force that does not seem to be particularly active or doing their job particularly well or even being sincere enough, Gabriel Byrne is probably not the right person to play a police commissioner. And there are some things in this film that are a little backwards based on what the police do. For instance, there's this one scene where Amy Ryan's character goes to a gated community where she ultimately concludes that was the last place where her daughter was seen. That's where her daughter made the frantic 911 call, and they traced it to that area, but somehow she ended up missing. But she's going around this gated community putting up missing person signs. There's one person who threatens to call the police, and within 10 minutes, the police arrive. But it's not just the police who arrive, it's the commissioner, played by Gabriel Byrne, who arrives, in Amy Ryan's words, in less time than it takes to make a sandwich. Great line, by the way. That's probably one of the better lines in this film. But first of all, why did the police commissioner arrive when he didn't know it was Amy Ryan's character who was there? And secondly, police commissioners, I imagine, would be too busy pushing papers in the office to get in a patrol car and go respond to a trespassing call. So that didn't make particular sense. Plus, Gabriel Byrne does play sympathetic very well. I mean, he usually plays that in a lot of movies, including horrific movies like Hereditary. And I say that in the best way, because Hereditary was an excellent film, one of the best films of the last decade. But in any event, Gabriel Byrne's probably the wrong person to play the head of an inactive or maybe apathetic police department. I'm just saying. But again, if the police in this film were depicted like Chief Wiggum in The Simpsons, that would also probably raise some eyebrows from several viewers, including myself. But I don't think the movie accurately shows why the police were particularly inactive, because being related to police officers, I would give the police force overall the benefit of the doubt when it comes to finding missing persons, because missing persons happen in this country, in this world, all the time. And there are literally tens of thousands of people out there who are reported missing to the police all the time. And they go years, maybe even decades, without finding those people. So I can understand the police being overwhelmed by missing persons cases, but there had to be another reason that the police seemingly stalled on finding Shannon Gilbert before they ultimately did. And this movie doesn't exactly give very good reason for that. And for that reason, even though it has an amazing performance in here by Amy Ryan, who plays a justifiably grief-stricken mother, I just didn't really get behind this film as much as it could have been. It just missed being great to me. But it does get my rating of a checkout because of the strong performances and the very impressive directorial debut of a feature dramatic film by Liz Garbus. Liz Garbus has been making documentaries for 25 years, but her first narrative film, while flawed, is a very good start, and I would be very interested to see her next film. But if I were to say about the epilogue, what's wrong with that? That's going to be a big spoiler, so I will end my review there right now. Listening to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. And I'm so happy to be on this show, on the air. I am so psyched to be here and talk about my favorite topic, which is movies. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is one that came out around Christmas time, but I'm reviewing it now because, first of all, I wasn't hosting the show around Christmas time. My show was still on hiatus. And secondly, it just came out on Blu-ray, 4K, and digital streaming on Tuesday, March 31st. So now's the best time to review Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. Now, before I get into my review, I just want to say that it's been released on those three platforms that I mentioned, but you might be wondering, why isn't it released on DVD? And that's a very good question. My guess is not that DVD is fading out. I don't think DVD will ever... I was going to say that it might not ever go away. That's not true. It eventually will. But it's not going to be anytime soon. I do think there are movies that are good enough to watch on DVD, but there are about probably 10% of movies that are very much worth seeing on Blu-ray and 4K if you can get it. Any Star Wars movie, most especially ones that were made during the Blu-ray and 4K age, like the ninth Star Wars movie, The Rise of Skywalker, are amongst those films. Yeah, to see this movie on DVD would, at this point, just not be worth it. And I do actually commend Disney for holding off on the DVD release because it certainly wasn't worth it. What I do not commend Disney for doing is releasing this film as soon as they did, because I think that audiences as a whole, thanks to Disney releasing 5 Star Wars films in 5 years, they oversaturated it. I was definitely afraid, even back in 2016, when Disney released Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, I said back then, Disney is going to oversaturate the market with Star Wars films, and this is going to hurt the franchise. I was partly right. I do think that of the 5 Star Wars films that have been released over the last 5 years, 3 of them were excellent, but Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker was decent. It had a lot of great special effects, as you might expect from both a Star Wars movie and a movie directed by J.J. Abrams. But here's the story of Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. The surviving members of the Resistance face the First Order once again, and the legendary conflict between the Jedi and the Sith reaches its peak, bringing the Skywalker saga to its end. Now, that synopsis right there, which I did not write, by the way, is a very fitting... It's an excellent synopsis of the film. But unfortunately, one of the things that really bogs this movie down is the fact that they didn't focus on the story. There was so much going on. There was a lot of shooting, a lot of spacecraft flying, a lot of lightsaber fights, but the fitting conclusion that I was really, really hoping to get from the last great Star Wars movie, which was Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, was not there. Plus, I would have thought, and this is a very minor grievance, I would have thought that the 8th movie would have been called The Rise of Skywalker, particularly because you meet Luke Skywalker for the first time in on the big screen in 34 years and in that movie. And you would think The Rise of Skywalker would be a fitting title for that movie. But, nah, again, it's a minor grievance, but, you know, the main problem with Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker is not the title. It's the fact that there is way too much going on. And I wanted to be excited about this film. You have the great actors of the last 2 chapters of the Star Wars saga. You have Daisy Ridley coming back as to play Rey. And I love Daisy Ridley. She's amazing in these films. You also have John Boyega coming back as Finn. You have Oscar Isaac coming back as Poe Dameron. And also some other characters. Of course, Adam Driver coming back as Kylo Ren. And what I loved about Kylo Ren from the eighth movie was you could actually see his character becoming less like a clone of Darth Vader and forming his Kylo Ren's true identity, which is, of course, not just a Darth Vader knockoff. That's what I was a little afraid of when I saw the seventh Star Wars film, Star Wars The Force Awakens. I did have a very minor grievance with The Force Awakens being basically an unofficial remake of the first Star Wars movie, i.e. Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. It didn't damage my enjoyment of the film. I still thought that, unlike the three Star Wars prequels, The Force Awakens had focus on a story, and it also had time to develop really potentially interesting characters. They also did not have annoying characters that pandered to children like Jar Jar Binks. And I respected the hell out of the movie for that. It had cute characters like BB-8, but again, it wasn't pandering. They fit into the story really well. And they also didn't concern themselves with Easter eggs. But I felt like this film, even worse than Solo, A Star Wars Story, put in the Easter eggs there. And unfortunately, when you focus on action and Easter eggs and not story, you get a story that's not particularly memorable. And I would have thought that, especially with the transformation of Kylo Ren's character from the eighth movie, The Last Jedi, this movie would have continued that story and character arc. But it doesn't. But the thing that really, really infuriates me about this film is Darth Sidious makes an appearance in this film. And Darth Sidious, I'm going to do a little bit of a spoiler here because I don't know of any of you who have not seen Return of the Jedi yet, but if you have, keep pushing that play button, but turn the sound down. Darth Vader kills Darth Sidious, unquestionably, at the end of Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi. How he is still alive in this film, decades later, is, I guess you could say Earth decades later, is never explained. What he's doing in this movie is never explained. So I shouldn't be infuriated about this because it's just a movie, but again, there was that lack of explanation there, which undermines a lot of the things that are going on in this film. And I could go on about certain characters that meet their death, but that would be putting in my spoiler, that would be going against my spoiler-free rule, basically. So, Star Wars Episode 9 is not a film that I hated, but I give it a checkout because, a marginal checkout, because I just think the acting was good, the special effects were impressive, but man, it's disappointing, and maybe this would get it to being a strikeout, but I can't exactly say that it was a huge disappointment. I just have to say the story could have been so much better. And I think that if the Disney company had just taken a year and let J.J. Abrams, as well as the producers and the editors, just focus on making a film with a clear narrative and maybe even having the guts to make this film 3 hours or longer, that it would have been another great chapter in the Star Wars franchise. This movie is not as bad as the three Star Wars prequels, but it's not better than any of the other films. I would probably say, of the 9 films in the Star Wars canon, this one is probably number 6 in terms of quality. So it gets a marginal checkout. Because I just think this movie, with all the money they put into it and the time, it could have been so much better. And I do blame the Disney company for pushing this film out as much as it did. And I would expect better from the Disney company, not only because it's already making buckets of money from other films, including its live-action remakes, but also the fact that Disney can afford to have time to have these films be incubated. In other words, to have the directors and the cinematographers put that finishing touch on it, and this Star Wars film felt rushed. It wasn't bad, but it was definitely pushed out before it could really get the amount of flourish that it needed. Listening to me, your host and movie critic Dan Burke, on the show Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. And the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film, about movies or otherwise, are solely those of your host and movie critic Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees who are working or volunteering at the station airing this broadcast, or the station as a whole. So now that I've reviewed all the films that I have to review for you for this show, it's now time to get into what's coming up next. But truth be told, this is usually the part of the show where I give you a spoken word preview of movies that are coming out in a theater near you. But because of the coronavirus, and because, understandably, movies all over movie theaters all over the country are closed, I can't exactly give that to you right now. So instead, I'm going to give you a rundown of movies that are coming out coming out on DVD, Blu-ray, and potentially streaming starting this coming Tuesday, which is April 7th, 2020. And let me just get this on my screen. Let's see. There are actually quite a few films that are coming out, some very good ones, or at least ones that I have heard are good, and some of which I heard are terrible. One of the ones I've heard that is good that I unfortunately haven't seen yet is the recent adaptation of Little Women that has been nominated for several Academy Awards and won 3. It was controversially not nominated for Best Director, but for Greta Gerwig, who directed the film, but still, it received a lot of accolades and probably got the attention that it deserved. But it has a stellar cast, two of the members of whom have been nominated for Oscars. It includes Saoirse Ronan, who was nominated for Best Actress, Florence Pugh, who was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, and both of them play Joe and Amy March, respectively. The other two March sisters in the movie are Meg, who's played by Emma Watson, and Beth, who's played by Eliza Scanlon. And other actors in the film include Laura Dern, who plays the matriarch of the March family, Marmy. And Laura Dern won an Academy Award this year, but that was for Marriage Story. She did not win or was nominated for this film, but I'm sure she's excellent in it. But then again, I don't know. The patriarch of the family is played by an interesting casting choice, Bob Odenkirk. And I can't vouch for how good a dramatic actor Bob Odenkirk is, but he's been on dramatic shows like Breaking Bad and the very excellent Better Call Saul. And I'm very stoked to see the latest episode of Better Call Saul. But even in those shows, Bob Odenkirk is more of the comic relief. I'm not sure if you can say he's the comic relief in this film, but people who are who have seen the film and can probably vouch for it more than I can might say that he is. But I can't say anything about that. All I can tell you is that it's going to be available on DVD and Blu-ray on this coming Tuesday, April 7th, and it's probably going to be released on streaming as well. But I will actually make a point to see the film, and I will let you know what I think when I eventually see it. Another film which I'm actually going to seek out is one that came out in theaters briefly in January. I don't think it did particularly well at the box office, but it is Doolittle, starring Robert Downey Jr., where he plays the titular Dr. Doolittle who can talk to animals. From what I've heard, this is more of a remake of the 1967 Academy Award nominated musical, probably one of the last musicals to come out of that era of Hollywood, because Hollywood was about to change forever in the late 1960s, and Dr. Dolittle, while it was critically acclaimed, it did bomb because it was one of those films, especially one of those musicals, along with Hello, Dolly, which came out around the same time, that was just not keeping up with the times. It was of a bygone era. Dolittle, starring Robert Downey Jr., I don't think is a musical, but it probably has more in common with that 1967 movie than it does the 1998 film starring Eddie Murphy. That film was more of a farce. It wasn't a bad film. I enjoyed it very much. And it was probably Eddie Murphy's best family-friendly film, if perhaps you don't count Mulan. But in any event, Dolittle is coming out on DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K. And I do think that this is a film that might be worth seeing in 4K, because all the animals in the film who do talk, that much I know about the film, are CGI animated. Dolittle is a film that I hope comes out on streaming, because I'm not exactly one of those people who orders Blu-rays online. I actually like to go to the store to order it. I'm a little bit of a Luddite that way. But Dolittle is a film I will seek out in one way or another. Whether I see it in high definition or not, I will let you know what I think when I eventually see it. Another movie that's coming out on Tuesday, April 7th is one I could tell you is flat out horrible. This movie is Cats. And if you have not heard, not necessarily from me, but just about anybody who's seen this film, it is flat out horrible. If you don't believe me, go online, go on to YouTube, type in Cats reviews. It is astonishing how many people hate this movie, but it's actually not astonishing when you actually see the film and realize how bad it is. It's a combination of a lot of things, and because I have seen this film, I will let you know what I think about it next week. But man, I am so itching to talk about this film right now, but I will save it until next week. But there are a couple of other films that are coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, and that's it. There aren't any other films that are coming out on 4K that I know of. In terms of TV shows, there's the final season of Madam Secretary, but I haven't seen a single episode of that show, so I can't vouch for it one way or the other. And even if I could, this is words on film, not words on TV shows. A lot of people have said that I should review TV shows on the show, but I don't, mainly because TV shows take a long time to watch. I was very, very tempted to review Tiger King, which is not exactly a TV show. It's more like a limited series, which kind of counts as a movie. But the reason I didn't is because it to me counts as a TV show. It's sort of a, it felt like a reality TV show, but man, it is a limited series that I will just briefly recommend, because the people in the movie are entertainingly crazy. But I shouldn't say entertaining, because a lot of people in this film meet a fate that is arguably worse than death. And that's all I'm going to say about the film. I think saying that it's a fate worse than death semi-spoils a movie or a series, but take my word for it, it's not necessarily death that some of these people encounter. It is quite shocking what some people do. There is another film, and I'm going to go back to talking about films now. There's one that is coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, and it's a movie that's called Swift. I'm going to look this one up because I haven't seen it. But I am going to, if you'll excuse me, look it up right now. Okay, I can't exactly look it up. It's a shame, but oh, here it is. So this is a movie that is, I presume, released in other countries, because the poster says it's called Manu, but it's actually, but the site I'm on says it's called Swift. And it's a movie that I assumed, based on the differing titles of the poster and the listing, that it was a foreign film, but it turns out it isn't. It has some American and English actors in it, including but not limited to Willem Dafoe, Kate Winslet, and Rob Paulsen, so some very big names in here. It's directed by two people, Andrea Block and Christian Haas. And this is a movie about a character by the name of Manu, who is a swift, whatever the hell that is, who has always grown up believing he's a seagull. And for him, or her, I can't tell what, self-discovery hasn't always been so easy. But once he finds out who he is, again, I guess this is animated. This site isn't telling me very much. Once he finds out who he is, whatever he is, whether he's human, I guess he's apparently not a seagull, he's able to use his signature self-determination, and he becomes a bit curious about what he can do to learn more about his mysterious origins. And when both the seagulls and the swifts, I guess the swift is a bird, unexpectedly find themselves in a world of trouble, it seems that Manu is the only one capable of bailing them all out. So, I was not given very much information about this movie, clearly. I think it's an animated movie that came out in other countries that was produced by somebody in some other foreign country. But when it was brought to the United States, and it was released last year on February 28th, 2019, some well-known celebrities like Willem Dafoe and Kate Winslet were hired to dub over as the voices of these characters. It's something that happens with international distribution, especially amongst anime films all the time. But it also happens with animated films from other non-English speaking countries, of which this is one. I have no idea what the hell a swift is. I assume from the poster it's some kind of pterodactyl-like bird, in which case, if you look like a pterodactyl, why the hell would you want to become a seagull? I don't know, but the film Manu, aka Swift, will be out on DVD and Blu-ray on April 7th. Pardon me for having not enough information about it, but that's just basically what I get when I have access to limited information, including on the Wi-Fi that I do. But it's not a fault against any of the streaming that I have here. Actually, I have great Wi-Fi here, so I'm not complaining about that at all. But that just about concludes this show, Words on Film. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke, just telling you that the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film about movies or other topics are solely those of yours truly, your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees or volunteers who are working at the station that is airing this broadcast or the station as a whole. I'm just here for your informative purpose. Maybe some people find the show entertaining, and to them I say thank you. But mainly, I'm not here to entertain. I'm here to inform. I'm here to tell you, based on my personal opinion, what movies you should see, what movies you should skip. And I did actually mention before I got into this outro that I'm doing right now that Cats is a movie that absolutely sucks. But maybe I'll get into this a little bit later when I'm actually reviewing the show for you reviewing the movie for you next week. It's a film that kind of has to be seen to be believed, but at the same time, there are things in the movie that I would pay somebody to unsee for me. And I have seen some messed up movies, but none of them, including many of the horror films, compare to Cats. But that's about all I'm going to say for Cats right now. Until next week, this is your host and movie critic Dan Burke saying I'll see you at the movies.